The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Pat Kelger, and I would like to welcome you to the Free Library and to welcome you to the continuing series, Cool Books, Hot Topics. Tonight, we welcome back to Philadelphia and to the Free Library, Mr. Elin Harris, whose memoir, What Becomes of the Brokenhearted, has just been published by Doubleday. Mr. Harris is the best-selling author of 8 novels. 3 of his novels have been optioned for film, Invisible Life, and Just As I Am, by Showtime, and Not a Day Goes by actress Pam Grier for her production company. Our guest author is here to talk about his newly published memoir, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention that he has won numerous accolades and prizes for his work. To name just a few, in 1996, Just As I Am was awarded Blackboard's Novel of the Year Prize. In 1997, If This World Were Mine was nominated for an NAACP Image Award and won the James Baldwin Award for Literary Excellence. Abide With Me, Any Way the Wind Blows, and A Love of My Own were also nominated for the NAACP Image Award. In 2002, Any Way the Wind Blows won Harris his second Blackboard Novel of the Year Prize. And A Love of My Own was recently named Blackboard Novel of the Year, making Mr. Harris the first author to receive back-to-back honors and to receive the prize a record 3 times. Currently, there are over 3 million copies of his novels in print. Mr. Harris is a popular college lecturer, and this fall, he will be a visiting professor in the English department at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, his alma mater. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming back to Philadelphia the talented, popular, New York Times best-selling author, Mr. Elin Harris.
Thank you, Pat, for that wonderful introduction. Pat said she heard me speak some time ago at the Black Librarians, and I think we're in Raleigh or Winston-Salem. It's good to be back here. It's good to be back here in Philadelphia. This is the second week of the tour. I'm going to take my sunglasses off when I begin to read. Just a few questions for logistics. When we get to the Q&A, they have microphones, and they would prefer that you guys use those so that I wouldn't have to repeat the questions. With the cameras, hold off on those. My eyes aren't bothering me this year, but it's still annoying. And here, there she go. I will gladly take pictures with you after all of this is over. And so keep turn your cameras off, turn your phones off, please. So here we go. Not a novel, but a memoir. I want you to know that this book took me 7 years to write. I think it is the most important book that I have written thus far in my career, and that is for several reasons. It was one of the most painful books for me to write. Thus, it becomes painful for me to read it in public. I've been trying to get a groove because whenever I read this, since this, in fact, did happen, I have to go back to that time. When I read from my novels, I can just make up where the scene is. It's not something that I've actually lived. So the tour, has been, I wouldn't say it has not been difficult in a sense because people are still turning out and people, I've gotten more emails on this book than any book ever. And I really do feel like it's touching lives and touching people. And so for that, I'm very, very grateful. But it's just difficult for me, only for these minutes when I read it. I want you to know that, my life is really, really in a wonderful, wonderful place, more wonderful than it's ever been. But just when I read this, I have to go back to that time, and I have to take over for that little boy and for that young man who became Elaine Harris. I'm going to skip around because I don't like y'all reading along with me. I want you to hear the way it happened, and I want you to hear the way I heard it. I wanted the first line of my memoir to be brilliant, something poetic that would linger long after the final page had been turned. But I have learned that life brings you only lightning-like bursts of brilliance, and they are rarely lyrical. There's no other way to say it. I tried to kill myself one humid summer evening. Thank God I failed. It was August 1990, after the day's heat had broken, and I wandered around my one-bedroom Washington, D.C. apartment, hopelessly depressed. Even though it was the beginning of a new decade, I was wondering how I had survived the previous two. I had been depressed before, but never to the extent I felt in the days preceding that night. I drank a bottle of Corbel champagne and then made calls of desperation to my favorite Aunt G and her son Kenny, a minister who lived right outside of Atlanta. I mumbled on a few minutes about how bad my life was. They told me that they loved me, but I already knew that. They told me to trust in God and pray. I told them I would try to feel better, even though I felt God wanted no part of me. In my state of sadness, nothing I could say could explain how I felt, that my family's love was not enough, and that I had no reason to believe in God, much less live another day. I was convinced that I would die one of the brokenhearted. One of the things that happened after that is I went into intense therapy, and after several months of therapy, my doctor suggested that I go back home to Little Rock to make a connection with my family, if only for a visit, because during all of this depression, I kind of left them out. And this talks about that visit. During the visit, a table in the corner of Grandma's tiny studio apartment captured my attention. Covered with various knickknacks and a faux crystal candy dish, the table hosted pictures of all her children, grandchildren, and great-grands, a pictorial history of our family. One picture stood out. In the middle of the table, in a dusty silver frame, there was a sepia-color photo of a little boy. He looked about 2 years old. Smiling with tiny teeth, he had lively teddy bear brown eyes and dark sandy-colored hair neatly parted. He looked happy, like he didn't have a care in the world. "Grandma, who is this?" I asked as I picked up the picture to inspect it closer. "Let me see, baby," she said as she reached for her glasses. But before I showed the picture to her, it dawned on me that the little boy in the photo was me. I stood transfixed, looking at the picture and wondering if I was ever really that happy, and if so, whether I could be that happy again. In many ways, writing saves my life. It's my hope that sharing my experience will give hope to others who are learning to deal with their differences. I want them to know that they don't have to live their lives in a permanent don't ask, don't tell existence. Truth is a powerful healing tool. But my hope for this book doesn't stop there. I think there is a message here for anyone who has ever suffered from a lack of self-esteem, felt the pain of loneliness, and sought love in all the wrong places. The lessons I have learned are not limited to race, gender, or sexual orientation. Anyone can learn from my journey. Anyone can overcome a broken heart. This story, my story, is a voyage of simply seeking joy in being human. And unlike my novels, in which I can always craft a happy ending, here in the real world, happy endings can't be plotted and penned with colorful words packaged inside covers with beautiful people adorning them. In sharing my story, it's my hope that readers will see glimpses of their own life and then bring about their own happy endings by living one day at a time, discovering their true passions, and realizing that every life is a story worth telling. This is my story. Easter day is near. Easter day is. Beverly Smith, a chubby 10-year-old, paused. She had forgotten the words again. I wanted to shout out, "Easter day is here." Why couldn't she remember her speech? Even I knew her six-line speech. Instead of saying here, Beverly stuck her fingers in her mouth and twirled her thick, uncombed plaits with her free hand. She looked as though she was going to cry, but suddenly she began to giggle, much to the dismay of our Sunday school teacher, Miss Whitfield, and myself. Beverly's completion of her speech was the only thing that stood in the way of my practicing my Easter speech and then joining my friends for a quick game of kickball before twilight covered the colored section of the east side of Little Rock, Arkansas. It was the early 1960s, and we were the only three people left at the Metropolitan Baptist Church, an ash-gray building as big as its name and the centerpiece of our community of 40-plus families. I was frustrated. All the other children had practiced their speeches and darted out of the church onto the streets to play before their parents called them in. It was not the kind of neighborhood where whole families sat down for dinner together, like Leave It to Beaver, because in the 1960s, many of the black adults worked two jobs. In my neighborhood, if your own parents didn't tell you to come in, then some other adult would, and you had better obey. I got tired of looking at Beverly, so my eyes moved to the wooden boards with the black slip-in numbers, listing the hymns from the previous week and the total attendance of Sunday school. I could hear the laughter and shouts filter in through the open windows of the church. From the voices, I could tell my peers were playing the popular game of hide-and-seek, where the seeker sang, "Honey, honey, bee, bar, bee, bar, bee, I can't see you, see you, see. Last night, night before, 24 robbers were at my door. I got up, let them in, hit him in the head with a rolling pin." Miss Whitfield had saved me for last because I had the longest speech, 22 lines. A speech that long was usually given to kids in the sixth grade and never to an eight-year-old. I had memorized each line the first day I received the typewritten speech. As Beverly started over and once again struggled for the words to her speech, my thoughts wandered to the upcoming Sunday. As my eyes left the wooden boards and moved toward the empty pulpit, I thought how proud my mom and daddy would be when they saw me stand before the congregation in my new Easter coat. Easter Sunday was the one time during the year where I could count on daddy being at church alongside my mother. In my fantasy, church members would not only marvel at my presentation, but my new coat as well. They would question where the coat had come from and how my parents could afford such extravagance with three children. Little colored boys from my neighborhood were lucky to get a new shirt and possibly a clip-on tie for Easter or Christmas. With a little coaxing from Miss Whitfield, Beverly finally finished her speech. I quickly jumped from the pew, raced to the front of the church, and said my speech in record time, every word perfectly clear and correct. "That's wonderful, Ann, but slow down a little on Sunday. Nobody's going anywhere until you finish," Miss Whitfield smiled. I nodded and smiled back, taking note that my accuracy had removed the anguish her face had shown during Beverly's struggle. Easter Sunday, 1964, finally arrived. After my bath, I raced into the tiny room I shared with my two younger sisters and saw the coat laid out on my twin bed. It was red, black, and green plaid with gold buttons. Daddy and I had picked the coat out together at Dundee's men's store. The coat had been on layaway since the day President Kennedy was shot in 1963. It's strange how vividly I remember that rainy and dreary day and how I tried to contain my excitement about getting out of school early while all the teachers at Bush Elementary were in tears over the news they had heard over the intercom system. After I got home that day, Daddy and I walked to the cold, in the cold to the edge of downtown Little Rock. At first, I thought that maybe I was going to the president's funeral when Daddy said he and his little man, Mike, were going to Dundee's to buy new suit coats. I realized that this was not the case when an elderly white man gave him a great payment book. The coat was the first piece of clothing that I could remember that hadn't come from J.C. Penney's or Kent Dollar Store, and was the first piece of clothing I had picked out. Now, Easter was here, and I could wear my new jacket. Mama had assembled it alongside a pair of black pants, white shirt, and a red and black clip-on bow tie, and the shoes my daddy had polished to perfection sat under the bed. I quickly put on my new clothes, and I could see my sisters, Anita and Zatoria, who were 5 and 3, slip on their dresses over freshly pressed hair. Anita had on a blue taffeta dress, and Shane, our nickname for Zatoria since her name was so hard to pronounce, had on an identical one in pink. Their dresses were pretty, but didn't compare to my coat. From the bathroom, Mama urged us to hurry while Daddy called from the living room for us to gather for a final inspection before we left for Sunday school. My sisters grabbed their black patent leather pocketbooks and raced to the living room to greet Daddy. I peeked from the corner of our room to watch Daddy's reaction. "Look, Daddy, don't we look pretty?" Anita said as she twirled around. Shane giggled as she put her pocketbook strap to her mouth. "You sure do look good. Look at my little girls. Shane, take that purse out of your mouth, baby," Daddy said. After Anita and Shane had accepted their compliments from Daddy, he called me in for inspection. "Where's my little man? Come out here and let Daddy see that new coat," he said. I quickly buttoned up each of the three gold buttons and dashed to the living room for Daddy's endorsement of my outfit. "Look, Daddy, look at me," I said with excitement as I twirled around like my sisters had moments before. Suddenly, Daddy's bright smile turned into a disgusted frown. What was wrong? Didn't he like my new coat? Had Easter been canceled? "Come here, stop that damn twirling around," Daddy yelled. I stopped and moved toward Daddy. He was seated on the armless aqua vinyl sofa. Before I reached him, he grabbed me and shouted, "Look at you, you fucking little sissy with this coat all buttoned up like a little girl. Don't you know better? Men don't button up their coats that way." Before I could respond or clearly realize what I had done wrong, I saw Daddy's powerful hands moving toward me. His grip was so quick and powerful that I felt the back of my prized coat come apart. A panic filled my tiny body when I saw his hands clutching the fabric. I began to cry as my sisters looked on in horror. I could hear Mama's high heels clicking swiftly as she raced to the living room from the kitchen. "Ben, what are you doing?" Mama asked. "Shut up, Adam, I'm taking care of this. Stop all that damn crying. Stop it now," Daddy said to me. I couldn't stop crying as I saw one of the gold buttons roll under the metal television stand into the corner of the room. "If you don't stop that crying, I'm going to whip your little narrow ass," Daddy warned as he released me. Now I was crying harder than before. Snot dripped from my nose to the top of my lips as my mother inspected my barely torn coat. "Come here, baby. Stop crying," she said as she pulled me close to her chest. "Let him go. Stop babying him," Daddy said as he pulled me from my mother's embrace. "How is he ever going to become a man with you babying him all the time?" he yelled. Mama didn't answer. She never did when he talked in this tone. She knew this routine too well. "Stop that sniffling and clean your face, you little sissy," he said to me. "What are you going to wear to church now?" I didn't answer, and I wiped my nose with the arm of my prized jacket and began crying once again. "If you don't stop that damn crying, I'm going to make you wear one of your sister's dresses to church." I caught myself and stopped crying. Daddy meant what he said. I would be the laughingstock of the entire neighborhood. It wouldn't matter that I had the longest and most difficult speech. I could see all my friends pointing and laughing at me. I looked at the anger in Daddy's eyes and the fear on my mother's face as I blinked back tears. The small four-room clampboard house was silent with the exception of my sniffles. The living room suddenly felt too small, the ceiling too low. I looked around the room at my mother and sisters and then out the window and watched the cars race past our house on East 21st Street. I don't remember much after my mother pulled me back into the bedroom. I remember standing before the packed church that Easter Sunday and hearing my name being called and the older ladies of the church adorned in their Easter Sunday finery saying, "Go ahead, baby, preach the word." I said my speech, each word of the 22 lines. I could hear the polite applause and amens that followed as I, with my head held low, took my appointed seat on the pew with other children from my Sunday school class dressed perfectly in their finest clothes. I don't remember what I wore that Easter Sunday or many Easters that followed. All I recall is that I wasn't wearing a dress, and I remember what my daddy had said to me. I didn't know what a sissy was and why Daddy despised them so. All I knew is that I was determined never to be one. There you have it. Let's see here. I don't know, but my editor thought that this was needed. This was something I added into the memoir afterwards, and Who knows? This could have been the beginning of Basil. It was during my ninth grade year that I had my first sexual encounter. It was with a girl from the neighborhood who had made advances toward me. One evening, when her parents were still at work, she invited me up to her bedroom. I remember feeling both excited and nervous, wondering if I was doing it right, and for days I couldn't get the intoxicating smell of sex out of my mind. We had sex a couple of more times before I surrendered to the other sexual thoughts I had tried to suppress since seventh grade. I would learn that other young men were thinking the same things I was. I wasn't the only one. One morning, while I was walking to Westside Junior High, I passed the massive Central High, as I did every day, and spotted the object of my first bout of lust, a boy two grades ahead of me. I knew who he was because he was a track and football star for the Central High Tigers. That morning, our eyes met briefly, and I felt tiny sparks dance through my body. This was something that hadn't happened when I had been with the girl. A couple of days later, I was headed home, and I passed Quigley Stadium, which was adjacent to Central. I saw him again. This time, he was wearing a sleeveless T-shirt that was cut right above his navel and gray running shorts, and he was carrying a football helmet. I couldn't help but stare at his honey amber skin and marvel at his body, one that was perfect and usually reserved for Greek statues. He caught me staring at him and walked toward me. I expected him to angrily demand what I was looking at, but instead, in a wordless command, he motioned for me to follow him into an empty corner of the stadium, into the sun-pooled shades of twilight, and I had my first physical contact with the boy, a boy who looked and carried himself like a man. The sexual contact went on for more than a semester, usually at my mother's house in the early morning after my sisters had left for school, even though he would barely talk to me. Still, I loved the way he smelled and how my heart would race when I would see him silently take off his skin-tight jeans to reveal white jockey underwear that always looked new. It ended one morning when I spotted him and several other Central High football players, both black and white, sitting on cars whistling at girls as they strolled toward the high school. Our eyes met briefly, and while I continued looking in his direction for some sort of recognition, he turned to a friend and whispered into his ear and started laughing so hard that he rolled off the car. I figured he had said something about me, and I increased my pace as I began to perspire with embarrassment. We would never meet at my mother's house or in our private spot in the stadium, as he started dating and later married one of Little Rock's most notable beauties after she became pregnant. Questions. Oh, before I answer questions, you guys know how I like to promote new authors. And there was a young lady in town tonight, and she saw that I was going to be here, and she thought that you may not come to her signing. And her name is Erica Simone Turnipseed, and she wrote a book called A Love Noir, and I've heard really wonderful things about it. She's here in Philly, and one of the reasons I tell you guys this is because when I first came to Philly, one of the first times I came to Philly, I wasn't getting big crowds and very small crowds. And I did one of these radio shows, one of these AM radio shows, and the Saints came after me in a big, big way. They were very, very cruel. This is after Invisible Life. And that evening was the first evening that I had a really large signing, because people in Philadelphia had heard the radio show and wanted me to know that everybody in Philadelphia wasn't like that. And so Philadelphia was indeed the city of brotherly love, and it has always held a special place in my heart for what you did for me that evening and what you have continued to do for me throughout my career. And I ask that you embrace all these other young authors as you have embraced me. Okay. Questions? No questions.
I just wanted to say that I love your books.
Thank you.
And I have a question. I actually completed a novel, and mm-hmm. I'm trying to get it published, and I've gone through trying to get with the literary agents and sending out the query letters, and I know you self-published your book. So mm-hmm. I was interested in knowing how you found actually a printing press to do the books.
I found one in Nashville, and they're no longer in business, but You can get several quotes. Get some quotes on how much it would take. It's a book called How to Self-Publish. I highly recommend that book. I would read it line by line, word by word. It's like a cookbook, and it tells you what to do. And you'll notice that when you print, even though you may be tempted to print 1,000 or whatever, it makes sense to print even a larger number just because of cost. But if you do self-publish, you know that it's going to be the hardest work that you've ever done, but possibly the most rewarding.
I just like to say thanks for letting us know what that E stands for. And can you really dance?
I used to could. I dance more in my head now. You know, I listen to the music.
Is the picture on the cover of the book your grandmother's picture?
Yes.
The one you referenced?
Yes.
Thank you.
One over here.
Oh. Hi. I just wanted to know, is it easier to discuss the material in here now that it has, because I know some people that keep journals, it's easier for them to deal with whatever it is that they put on paper. So is it easier now that you've published this?
Yeah, I felt like I owed it as somewhat of a public service because, you know, people had the I wouldn't say the wrong impression of me because a lot of people came on to me when I was very, very successful. And they see me now and they see, you know, my life the way it is now, which is a very wonderful life, a very, very happy life. And I know there's so many people out there that found a great deal of solace in my novels. And I just thought if they could find some solace in my life, something that actually happened, that it was something that I should be willing to share. And it was difficult for me, and it's still difficult. I remember getting the book and reading through it and wondering how I had ever really, you know, survived some of that stuff. I survived it so that I can thrive today.
What inspired you to start writing?
Actually, events from my life, depression. Depression actually started me to writing as a way of working my way out of it.
Took 7 years to actually finish the book. Now that it's done, is there sort of a closure or any fulfillment that you've gotten now that you're done?
The closure will happen when this tour is over. Yeah. When I don't have to read this out loud and I don't have to ask reporters questions about it, I can finally put that behind me. But every time I read it, I really do have to go there. When I was, even though I'm here with you guys, I was back at 520 East 21st Street when I was reading that. And I had to write it for that little boy. You know, I had to write it for him. Up here.
Did you go into therapy for your depression?
Yes, I did. I was in therapy for a while. Not in therapy anymore. I haven't been on medication in about 6 years. So, you know, life is good. God is good.
In writing this, I noticed that you went through a lot of painful things. Is there a lot that was cut out, like that you just couldn't bear to see in print?
Yes, absolutely.
And what happened to the little boy Daniel that took to you?
That's a good question. Daniel probably is 22 now. It was one of those situations that I didn't write about in the book, but Daniel's mother, right when Just As I Am came out, and I was really getting popular. He used to go on a book signings with me and loved it just as much as I did. But his mother started dating someone who thought that it wasn't a good idea for him to be so close to a gay man. And so it was a decision that I had to make. You know, I didn't want to stop. It was causing friction between his mother and her new boyfriend. And you know, I couldn't know what he would do to win that battle because Daniel and I had been close for almost 5 years. And so we had definitely bonded. And my aunt told me, she said, Daniel loves you. He'll find his way back to you. And that's what I count on.
excuse me. I got the book from the library, and I've read a couple chapters. And what I've gotten the most out of was your prayer life. And I think it's been a good help for me to go on. I mean, I'm glad that it was such a help for you to be able to do that. And I'm sure other people will benefit from what you've written about it.
Thank you. I hope so. Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I also enjoy your books. But I want to know, even though this is nonfiction, how much of the fiction comes from things that you've done in life?
A little bit of this, a little bit of that. But since it's fiction, you know, it's made up. You know, I'll tend to give you guys glimpses of my glamorous life now in my novels. You know, some of the things that happen, I kind of work my way into the novels. So many people I meet on the road, and so many situations I've been involved with now.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant. That these experiences help you write the book, right?
Absolutely.
I'm not in the pursuit to write a book. However, I would like to write some things down for my daughter that mm-hmm. she'll always have things that she can refer to and so forth. And the thoughts come in my mind, but once I start to try to write them down, it just won't transfer from my mind thought to my fingers. And I was just wondering, is there a way or a class or something that I could take that will help me to transfer that information from my mind to the paper?
You know, I never recommend writing classes to people who really want to be writers, but I would recommend one for you. It might help you to get some of those thoughts together, especially since you're trying to keep them as journals for your daughter. What goes on in our head doesn't always end up on the paper. So I think there are probably classes that can help you, because you have something that you want to tell that's in your head, and you just got to figure out a way of getting it out. When you're making it up, then it becomes a little bit more difficult. So I would look in some of the university classes, or just the classes in New York. They have a lot of things called the Learning Annex. I'm sure they probably have it here in Philadelphia. And take classes from people who write for a living. Yeah. Good luck with it. Right here after her.
Good evening. I want to thank you for being so candid, because I know this definitely must not have been an easy write for you. But on your tour, I'm very curious if you're thinking about going into the prison systems at all, because there are many folks in there that have had the same kind of issues that you have, and it may be something very beneficial for them to hear from you.
That's not something that I would be opposed to and would welcome the opportunity. I'm looking forward to becoming a professor this year. It's been very easy to write checks to the University of Arkansas. It's going to take more for me to give of myself, you know, to go to Fayetteville, trust me. And after living right across the street from Central Park in New York City, and then to go find myself living in Fayetteville, Arkansas, it's going to take a lot. But I think that it's going to do great things for the students there, I hope.
Mr. Harris, I enjoy reading your books, but I would like to know, who is your favorite author?
I don't really have a favorite author. There are several people that I enjoy. I enjoy the work of a lot of the African-American female writers. The book that touched me the most in my life, I guess, would have to be I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin, and A Native Son by Richard Wright. Right here in the middle.
Hi, Mr. Harris. I enjoyed your book, Just As I Am. I was on a road with the band, and I didn't feel like hanging out with the cats that night. And I just read your book, and I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, sir. That's usually preceded by, I'm straight, but I loved your book. I get that a lot on college campuses. Right here. Oh, right there. There you go. Hello.
Congratulations on your accomplishments.
Thank you.
And I believe everybody has a story worth telling.
Absolutely.
And it's good to know real people.
Thank you. You're so right. Was over here, and we're going to take about two more questions.
I have a statement first. I just wanted to tell you that reading your books kind of opened a door for me that I really never really understood the gay world at all. And you know, you have all these misconceptions and you hear what people tell you. And those books just opened doors that, you know, never would have opened to me before. And it just gives you a better understanding and to realize that, you know, we're all human. Everyone is.
Absolutely.
And you have to have compassion for all people. And the other thing I wanted to ask you is, will you be starting a new series? Please say yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. In the back there. The gentleman, then the lady, and then that'll be it. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I just wanted to know, I wanted to preface it first by saying Basil is a character. Now, I would like to know if Hollywood has beckoned you, and if so, who would play Basil?
Hollywood has beckoned me, but they don't know what to do with me. So, you know, who knows? I've seen, you know, people. Interestingly enough, the one person who I think that physically is Basil is not an actor. And it just so happened that now he's my, you know, best friend in the world. We met about 4 years ago at a casting when we were looking for a Basil. And we have since become best friends. And in my mind's eye, you know, Sean looks like I imagine Basil would look. But Sean's not interested in acting. Yeah. Hello.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
This is my third time coming to see you here in Philadelphia since I've been living here 3 years. And I just want to say thank you. I've read and I own every single one of your books, and it has also helped me to read other works from the anthologies that you've been in, etc. So for me as well, it has opened up a whole different world, and I'm just captivated and entranced, and I you can never stop because I don't know what I would do without your books.
What a happy way to end it. Thank you, sweetheart. Let me just say that the course that I'm teaching at the University of Arkansas is going to be a contemporary literature course, and I'm going to be posting the books that I'm teaching down there on my website so that you can read along with us. I'm going to make the class fun. You know, I want kids to fall in love with reading, and I want them to read about their own experience. So I'm going to be teaching people like Eric Jerome Dickey and Kimberla, you know, Lawson Roby and Tina Ansa, and a lot of the popular writers. So read along with us and come and visit the website, which is just www.edlinharris.com. I'm still the only one that answers all my fan mail. I'm the only one that reads it. I've been getting a lot of fan mail emails lately due to this book, and I'm so thankful for that. But I am so thankful to each of you for the support that you have given me in the past. And in so many ways, my life is a triumph because of people like yourself. I can't depend on your love to make sure that I remain focused and sane and healthy and happy, but I do cherish it. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.